paper. Now, just let me know and I can email you a copy of it. I have to say, you know, it's so exciting for this program to be developed. I've been advocating it since the 1970s. I hope the dean of the Dell School get fired for advocacy of the program. And really, I think wanted to be a general nurse. Couldn't quite accomplish that. But I was just, my question, Ron, is what about adult care? I mean, you have the program primarily directed towards children,
mm-hmm.
but you're also in areas, remote areas, where adults are also suffering acute disease problems. How do you handle that?
Well, what we learned from the Canadian program is that the dental therapists trained in 2 years can provide, you know, these basic services for both children and adults. And it is true that the New Zealand program focuses mainly on children because it's a school-based program. But there are New Zealand dental nurses that are involved in community-based programs as well. In our case, what we feel is that we're trying to interrupt the vertical transmission of disease, so we know that caregivers are part of that transmission process. And so folks felt pretty strongly in Alaska that we need to do both primary prevention for children, preventive and curative services for adults in combination because of that link between adults and children, their caregivers. And, of course, these are small villages. Most of them are populations under 1,000. And so, you know, if we just focus on children, that's not very many people in a village of 1,000. It may only be 300 or 350 people. So in order to have an economy of scale for these providers, they need to be able to provide treatment broadly for the community. And, of course, you know, there's a social aspect. You know, Larry Hill did a great job of explaining why it's important to have front teeth when you go for a job interview. And so we want these folks to be on equal footing, the parents, in terms of getting jobs and be socially accepted for that sort of thing. Amos?
To date, since these DHATs have been working in Alaska, has anything surfaced to leave anyone fearful?
No. Right. Is anyone? Have there been any untoward events that would leave folks fearful of treatment from
by
being careful of the dental therapist? No, I don't. I don't think anything has surfaced. Like most large programs where we see lots of patients, there are some patient complaints, and it's not unequally weighted between the therapist and the dentist. But there haven't been any events where patients have had to be hospitalized, or there hasn't been lawsuits and so forth. You know, I can't get in. I got in and they hurt me. You know, the shot hurt. You know, it's the usual sort of not incompetence, no. And in fact, I think the support for the dental therapist is pretty strong. And there's really sort of a competition of have and have nots now in Alaska, where villages that have, you know, a full-time therapist like Aurora Johnson, there's other villages that want their own, and so, you know, there's a lot of interest in, you know, further developing more therapists.
Have you made any progress in implementing 4-8-12?
Oh, yeah, we talked about that several years back, and because of the remoteness of these villages and the size, a lot of them don't have piped water, and the ones that do have piped water, there it doesn't serve all the houses. And so there's been some discussions about fluoride salt programs, especially after the PAHO paper came out in support of it. But we haven't moved on that. We're still trying to implement water fluoridation village by village. But we've had conversations about salt fluoridation. But in terms of, I think, support coming from, you know, NIH and CDC, I mean, I think that would be a key ingredient, not just the salt, but a key ingredient to succeeding with a program like that. And so far, we haven't made a lot of progress.
What about Kellogg? They should be interested.
You know, I don't know that Kellogg has thought about that. They're very much interested in workforce issues right now, the preventive side of things. I think they leave that to, you know, the folks involved in preventive dentistry in terms of research and so forth.
Thank you.
Larry?
You mentioned that APHA passed the resolution.
Right.
Do you know, or does anybody in the room know whether anything has happened with that? Those kinds of things go to their action board, and I'm wondering whether there's been any action. Because otherwise, it's just a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Without some action.
I think there was Ron. There was a provision in there that asked for an ongoing evaluation or a clinical assessment of the skill level, and I think that is starting, right?
Yeah, the Kellogg Foundation, under a separate program, has funded and hired a contractor, Research Triangle International, to do a fairly broad evaluation of the skills and the acceptability of the dental therapists in Alaska. And they're in the IRB process right now, so they've submitted paperwork to both the Indian Health Service IRB and to the tribal sort of subsets of that IRB process, and they're working that through. And it'll take about probably 3 years before we see papers generated from that effort. Well, the Indian Health Service in the Alaska Area Office basically created provisions to certify providers under the health aid statute. It's a federal statute. And basically Congress recognized the frontier nature of Alaska, realized that there wasn't going to be traditional providers in these 200 villages that are remote, and authorized the local IHS office in Alaska to organize this board and create certification standards to basically administrate this program.
Thank you very much. If you have any questions, we'll take them at the end of the session. The next presentation is titled Creating a New Health Profession, Dental Health Aid Therapist, by Dr. Ruth Bolweg. And she's a physician assistant and director of the MedX Northwest Physician Assistant Division and the University of at the University of Washington School of Medicine.
Thank you. You're welcome. So there's some redundancy between Ron's presentation and mine, but I think I have a little different emphasis on some things because of our partnership. When this whole project was developed, the sense was if we were going to get funding from major funders, and I don't know if you said that the Kellogg Foundation became the major funder, there was the requirement that there be some association with an academic health center. And that was a ticklish thing, as you might imagine, because there was concern, at least in the state of Washington, it was a risky thing for the dental school to be involved in this. Although early on there were a lot of conversations with the dental school, with the dental association, and there was a recognition that there were two ways to go about this. And so I want to talk about the MedX program at the University of Washington as a way of telling how we came up with a creative solution. Ultimately, the University of Washington, there was a lot of pressure put on the University of Washington. We thought that was a good thing. And it was put on by tribal groups all around the country who said, you really need to help us do this so that we don't have to send folks to New Zealand. That's a heck of a long way away, and it creates a lot of family disruption, and it was hard on the people. So from the very beginning, there were two thoughts about where this program might be. One was that it might be in the School of Dentistry, and the second one was that it might be in the MedX Northwest program, which had a long history of working in Alaska. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. We were particularly interested because we felt that the model of creating the physician assistant and nurse practitioner professions 40 years ago applied really to the idea of creating this new profession and might in fact apply. We're going to see a number of new health professions appear, I think, not just in dentistry and medicine, but in nursing and so forth in the next years. And so we're very interested in how might that happen. So that's partly how we got into it. So to tell you the background, some of you may know Dr. Richard Smith. He's the founder of the MedX program, and he's still alive. He's the only living founder of the PA profession, and he had some principles about founding new professions that we applied here. So first of all, he was a physician who was trained at Howard University, had public health training. He was one of the first medical directors of the Peace Corps. He was a leader, health leader in the Johnson administration. He was responsible. He was assigned to desegregate all of the U.S. hospital system, which in itself is quite a story, which means that he's a risk taker and a successful person at really pulling off innovative things. And then he came to the University of Washington and he created the PA program. He actually convinced the State Medical Association that it was their idea, so that was a pretty good idea. And you know that the best tool of political change is to get people to think it was their idea, so he was good at that. And after that, he went on to create Medics International at the University of Hawaii, which trained health workers in 66 countries of the world. So we sort of had the basis of his philosophy. And here's his model of how you go about creating a new profession. You don't simply create a training program, and I think that's the mistake that's often made. So the first part of his model is that there's a collaborative model. You talk to people about what you actually need, and certainly that's an example of what happened with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Corporation. All of us worked together, working with the tribal groups, working with a variety of different individuals, getting their input, and early on, before we even entered the system here, Ron and his group had decided what the role was going to be for the dental therapist. We continued those discussions. We continue to have discussions and essentially create some transparency about how this all works. So you don't do this in isolation. And over the years, we're going to hear more of the stories as they unfold and become safer to tell about what some of those stories were in the beginning. The second principle is the idea of competency-based training, and that's really what we're sort of the experts on. PA programs and military training programs historically have done competency-based training, where the first thing you decide is what people need to do, and then you work backwards. And you teach them the skills they need, but not the skills they don't need. Number three is probably the most important one, and it's the concept of a receptive framework. And that's the safety net that allows infrastructure that allows a new profession to exist. So in this case, ANTHC and the Alaska tribal groups had gotten Medicaid reimbursement approved for this. They had figured out how to make this work with a community health aid licensure. And over time, we'll see more and more aspects of that in terms of reimbursement. It really is critical. Then there's the idea of structured deployment. I think a lot of times programs are developed, and the idea is sort of like in medical school. Once somebody becomes professionals, they can decide where they want to go. Well, I don't think so. If you have funding, you want to have people go where the need is. And in fact, you actually want to choose people from the communities where they're going to end up being a good thing, not a bad thing. So as you look at the stories of these individuals, what you see is we've chosen them, they've been recruited, they've been encouraged from their community with the idea that they'll go back there. So that sort of assures success. The most difficult part is them getting through training, because it's very hard for people to leave their homes. And we've found that it isn't just hard for people to go to New Zealand for people from villages. It's hard to go to Anchorage and be there for a year. And so we purposely, for example, designed our schedule. The first decision that was made was when were the subsistence periods that people needed to be home for berry picking and fishing and so forth, moose hunting. I personally learned more about the subsistence schedule that I ever knew, and I really value that information. So how do you do that? The structured deployment with the idea that folks go back where they came from. Practitioner involvement. In this case, it's the dentists who are working for the dental tribal groups. And the idea that they're involved in the selection, the recruitment of people, but also that they're trained in supervision. So they're not just sent out there without any skills about how to work with this group of people. And they also continue to have input in the role. And then, of course, CME, we don't know that that's important. So if I have a most important slide in this presentation, it's really this one. So we got involved in it, as I told you, because of our experience with competency-based training. We're also, the University of Washington, where we are, is the only medical school for five states. A lot of people don't know that. The reason is nobody lives in those states, so it's not cost-effective to have a medical school for Wyoming and Idaho and Alaska and Montana. So we've always had a regional focus. The Medics program is one of the first two PA programs. We trained and deployed the first PAs in Alaska. We've had links with community health aid programs. As a matter of fact, we've recruited community health aides to be physician assistants. And we've had long-term relationships with the Alaska Native tribal corporation. So it made a lot of sense for us to work together. We didn't have to rebuild a trusting relationship or describe who we were. We could move ahead based on linkages, and that made this work a lot better and still is a secret to how this happens. It's an obligation if you have a story about Alaska slideshow. You have to have this map, even though Ron had it. So I've now completed my requirement. And you also have to have some scenic pictures. So these are really just pretty much to show what Ron's already talked about, the isolation. And the villages really are very small. And so everybody knows everybody. That's also a problem in choosing healthcare providers, because they may be taking care of their grandmother or their uncle or their nephew. And he also talked about the high cost of transportation and the harsh environment. But people like to see pictures of that anyway. I certainly do. So when we think about the health status of rural Alaska, we are worried about all of these things. One of the most interesting ones to me is rapid social change, because, in fact, there's huge dietary issues in Alaska related to pop and all the wrong foods, and that's a great example of social change that we maybe need to turn back, community isolation. But I think the most important thing is how serious dental issues are in Alaska. And we can have pages and pages of statistics. But when you think about kids missing school because of dental pain, also when you think that there are very few kids over four who still have all their teeth, and that many of those have been removed in hospital procedures in regional hospitals, it's terrifying. So this is, sorry, got a little bit overlapping. But the point that Ron talked about is that the federal government really recognized that you really need a different system there, and that it doesn't make any sense in particularly regional centers to have both private and public sectors, because there's duplication, and you really have to figure out how to be as effective as you can. And so there's different rules that apply. You saw a clinic there before. This is a little different one, but no matter what, it's the center of the town. It may be, aside from the school, the only place that has any jobs that actually are salaried. And so it's the center. Each community has its own board that runs its village clinic as well. So it's a politically sensitive issue as well. And here's the frightening thing, in that although there are dentists employed by the Alaska Tribal Health Agencies, they can only visit the clinic once a year for a week or two at a time. And when they do, they can only deal with the high incidence of serious disease. They really can't be focusing on prevention much as they might like to. They're dealing with unremitting dental pain and issues like that. So this happens to be a clinic that I visited, and it says the dental here is here in August, and it says all the other appointments are full. The next opening, this happened to be 6 weeks from the time we were there. So that's pretty typical of the kind of problems that you see. So we talked about this. We talked about it being a collaborative program. I think it's important to point out, so while the MEDEX program, which is in the School of Medicine, is managing this program, the teaching is done by dentists and dental educators. We've been fortunate to have dental faculty from the University of Washington who have come to visit us as consultants, as well as from other universities around the country. So here's our mission statement. It's designed to educate dental therapists, native communities. We're committed to train Alaska Native dental professionals, and you see from our pictures that that's really who we have. I think the most important thing to know is this is narrowly focused. So we're not having dental therapists do the same thing that dentists do. It's a much narrower scope of practice. This slide pretty much shows the difference between the two, with this being community-based, rural community recruited. It's a two-year program, dental supervision. So here's who we're talking about. High school diploma or GED as a minimum, tribal association sponsorship, prior experience in a dental or medical setting preferred. And there's a number of people that have been dental assistants or community health aides or EMTs or a variety of different things that we feel are appropriate. They have to have references from the tribal association, an employer or community leader. There has to be a personal statement about why I want to be a DHAT, and then there's an admissions interview. So the admissions interview is just, the admissions decisions are made by the program, not by the tribal groups. And you can imagine there might be some disagreement about that occasionally. So we have to work through that. So it features competency-based training with frequent frequent exams. That's what adult learners like. It's led by full-time on-site dentists who are in Anchorage and in Bethel. The dental school faculty who come up are from a range of institutions. We're especially proud of that. And it's culturally respectful and sensitive, which is critical. So this is the first group. Don't they have good-looking teeth? Several of them didn't before they came to the program, so they themselves have been patients in Anchorage. This is class two, and we're trying to do that receptive framework business. So we invited Senator Murkowski to come and join us, and there she is. She's been a strong supporter, as has the entire Alaska congressional delegation, obviously. To the right, you see Mary Willard, who's the dentist, who's the full-time person in Anchorage, who is an incredible teacher and incredible role model for our students. There's a prevention-based curriculum, and I think that's critical to what they'll be doing. This shows you what the curriculum is in Anchorage. By the way, the University of Washington Medical School runs the first year of its medical school in Anchorage, so there are a number of basic science lecturers who are available to help us in teaching some of these materials as well. Focus on community dentistry. And the second year is full-time in Bethel, Alaska, and that's about 350 miles west of Anchorage, not on the road system. You have to fly there, but there's a huge demand there. Bethel serves, 56 villages, I think, close to that, yeah. 25,000 people. So there's a huge waiting list, and so there's much more need there, so that's why the second year is there. And there are village practice rotations. More emphasis on telemedicine. You can see what the topics are. So I really want to focus on the idea that the dental therapist really has a limited scope of practice based on competency-based training. They're not to be compared with dentists, but in fact they're doing the procedures that Ron talked about. So here's the practice model. This happens to be one of the students who came back from New Zealand, and her dental assistant. Students are trained to work in a non-traditional work site, so here you're actually seeing them sort of capturing this kid on the fly for a dental exam, or to teaching them how to do brushing, which is probably pretty realistic. Ron talked a bit about quality control and safety. There's a requirement after certification for CME, as well as additional hours of preceptorship, recertification. And this is a website if you want to look any more at it. And finally, I'd like to suggest to you that there are three stages of a new idea. The first is ridiculous. I think we've been there. We're at the controversial stage, and we hope that eventually this model will be obvious to all of you. So thank you for your attention.
We have time for some questions. If anybody has any questions, yes.
Yes, that's after they graduate. I'll let Ron answer that because he's the expert on that.
When they get a certificate from this program, they go back to their supervising dentist, and part of that preceptorship is to establish that relationship between the dentist and the dental therapist.
Thanks.
Before they ever do any procedures under general supervision. The other part of it